glamorous and humble, adored and alone. Marilyn is a source of inspiration for me, and Lord, have I needed that. When I was in the 8th grade, there was a pack of pretty, mostly Irish girls whom I desperately wanted to befriend. At that time, in that town, most of these girls were considered the pinnacle of physical perfection. Milky skin, silky hair, and blue eyes. They used to have a chant, "Blue eyes rule." These were not nice girls. And I felt wholly inferior around them. Compared to them, and in the 8th grade, comparison is the only method of measurement, my skin was muddy, my hair was lawless. They called me Fozzie Bear from the Muppets because of my unruly hair, and try as I might, I could never flatten it all out to look like theirs, and even my eyes were distinctly and undeniably unblue. I liked my dark eyes, but I never stood up for myself during their weird chant. Clearly, I stood out from their group, but they let me hang with them. Maybe it was because I was the class clown, always quick to crack a joke or snap on somebody and make the whole group laugh. Even if I was only there as the entertainment, I was happy to put on a show. The girl in that clique who was my closest friend, and I use that word liberally, was also the prettiest. I guess now they'd call her a frenemy. I would tell her I was interested in a boy at school, and knowing full well I never acted on any of my crushes, she and her big blue eyes would go after him and almost always score. I believe she did this just to push me down, to let me know she had all the power. But what she didn't know was that I didn't ever pursue boys because I wanted to avoid the inevitable humiliation once they learned that half of me was black and all of me was poor. She also didn't know that I didn't want to get wrapped up in some stupid boy and derail my dreams, or worse, get pregnant like my sister. She didn't know me at all. None of them did. Some of the girls' parents did know my mother, however. They had a modicum of respect for her because she was also Irish and a professional opera singer, and opera was classy. Adult drama works differently than that among teens, but they often intersect. Word got out that the Irish father of the prettiest girl was physically abusing her mother. My mother, who can get really righteous when she wants to, took it upon herself to write him a letter. In that letter, I'm pretty sure she disclosed that she had been married to a black man and that he was the father of her children. Of course, I wouldn't learn of the letter until much later. As I said, these were not nice girls. But eventually, I was invited to go with some of them, including the prettiest one, to Southampton for a sleepover. One of them had a rich aunt, Barbara, with a fancy house near the beach. Fancy schmancy Southampton? A sleepover with the popular girls? Of course I wanted to go. We piled into one of their big cars and took the 2-hour-long drive along the lovely Atlantic edge of Long Island to the small village where the wealthy summer. Summer was a season for me, not a verb. The house was big, airy, and orderly. It even had an all-white room no one was allowed to enter. I was awestruck when we arrived, so busy comparing and craving that I hadn't noticed that the girls had gathered into a cluster by the door. They called over to me, "Come on, Mariah, let's go back here." Without question, I followed. They led me to what I thought would be a playroom or a den. I knew wealthy people had dens. It was a smaller room in the rear of the house, a guest room, perhaps. One of them shut the door with a click, and suddenly the mood grew heavy, fast. I thought maybe they'd snuck in some alcohol or something, but there was no excitement, no naughty, girly energy. Instead, all the girls were glaring at me. Suddenly, into the heavy silence, the sister of the prettiest girl spit out her ugly secret for all to hear. "You're a nigger." My head began to spin when I realized she was referring to me, pointing at me. It was my secret, my shame. I was frozen. The others quickly joined in. "You're a nigger," they all shrieked. All together, in unison, they chanted, "You're a nigger," over and over. I thought it would never end. The venom and hate with which these girls spewed this new iteration of their usual chant was so strong, it quite literally lifted me out of my body. I had no idea how to handle what was going on. It was all of them against me. They had planned it. They fooled me into thinking they actually liked me. They lured me hours away from home. They isolated me. They trapped me. Then they betrayed me. I exploded into hysterical tears. I was disoriented and terrified, and I thought that maybe if I held on and just kept crying, surely a grown-up would come and stop the assault. But no one came. Eventually, I heard another voice whimpering among the mob. "Why are you doing this?" the small, brave voice asked. It was the older blonde one, the ugly sister of the prettiest shopback, because she is a nigger. I don't remember anything else about that day. I don't remember the ride home. I don't remember telling my mother when I got back. How do you tell your all-white mother that your all-white friends just dragged you into their big all-white house in all-white Southampton, past an untouchable all-white room, just to corner you and call you the dirtiest thing in their all-white world, nigger? I was also scared my mother might make a massive public scene and make navigating life at school even more difficult for me. I had no language or coping skills for any of it. It was certainly not the first time I had been degraded by my schoolmates. I'd been singled out on the school bus and spit on. I'd gotten into physical fights. Often I would clap back. My tongue was sharp, and I could be a real wise ass. Sometimes I even started fights. But for this, I had no defense. I was not only outnumbered and isolated, I was bitterly betrayed. This was not your garden variety schoolyard mean girl scuffle. It was a devious and violent, premeditated assault by girls I called my friends. I never spoke of it. I stuffed it inside. I had to find a way to survive those girls, that town, my family, and my pain. She smiles through a thousand tears and harbors adolescent fears. She dreams of all that she can never be. She wades in insecurity and hides herself inside of me. Don't say she takes it all for granted. I'm well aware of all I have. Don't think that I am disenchanted. Please understand.
It seems as though I've always been somebody outside looking in. Well, here bleed, but they can't take my heart from me, and they can't bring me to my knees. They'll never know the
looking in.
Mariah only has 3 shirts and she puts them in rotation.
The cruel words crashed into the buzzing bustle of the in-between class traffic of my 7th grade hallway like a stink bomb. All the pattering of feet, clanging of lockers, chirping of small talk, and little giggles morphed into one giant laughing monster made of kids sitting in the middle of the hallway pointing at me. My stomach collapsed and my face burst into flames. I thought I might vomit right there on the tile floor. Middle school is a contact sport, and I was pretty skillful with my own sharp tongue. A lot of kids have to suffer having mean or funny names given to them by their peers because of how they look or some embarrassing event, but being teased for being poor felt like a different kind of cruel. I was severely injured, but I did not let it show. I didn't get sick in front of everybody. I didn't give anyone the satisfaction of seeing me weakened. I showed no emotion and waited patiently for the monster to melt away. As the traffic had to resume and kids had to get to their classes, I understood that there would be no recovering and no trying to belong. I would survive on the outside with 3 shirts and no friends in hopes that I would inevitably move again. In our middle-class community, I was extremely self-conscious of living with a shabby wardrobe in a small, dilapidated house. However, by the time I entered high school, I had developed some new survival skills. At that age, I didn't have any control over where I lived, but I could do something about what I wore. One of the few advantages of moving so many times was that I got a fresh crop of kids to try to fit in with. One go-around, I managed to scrounge together a few girlfriends and convince them we should have a fashion swapping system where we'd exchange our trendiest pieces with one another and coordinate them differently. This gave the illusion that I had a more expansive and up-to-date wardrobe than I could ever afford. coolest thing I owned was an oversized red wool and black leather varsity jacket with Avirex in big letters emblazoned across the back. It was a big deal for me to have a name brand item, so I made sure I had a signature piece that was adaptable to a variety of looks. I did my best to look the part of a typical cute suburban teen to fit in with all the other Long Island girls. By the time I was in the 10th grade, I was going out with the biggest and scariest dude in town. He was 6'5" and had biceps that were thicker than both of my thighs. He was in his early 20s, he had a car, and nobody messed with him. And that's the main reason why I was with him. He was a protector, a force field. The previous boy I had gone out with was volatile. We even got into a physical altercation in front of a group of girls who stood around and watched. After we broke up, he proceeded to stalk and harass me. A real charmer. Mr. 6'5" caught him verbally attacking me and proceeded to lift him up off the ground and toss him over 5 parked cars. Pow! He actually was pretty cool beyond his brute strength. But high school can be treacherous, especially for an outsider like me. So having the toughest guy in town as my guy was good for that moment. There was a crew of girls who were into a 60s tie-dyed Grateful Dead vibe that I never understood. It was the late 80s and the street trends were so fresh, I really didn't get what they were doing. Why were they hearkening back to such a random retro look? Also, they were aggressive and hard, not hippies, deadheads, or peace lovers at all. Being the smart aleck I was, I named them the Peace People. Word got out that I was making fun of them and they were pissed. Rumblings started circulating that I was going to get my ass kicked, but Mr. 6'5" was famous. Everyone was afraid of him, so getting at me wasn't that simple. One morning, after completing my routine of going to the bagel station to get a bagel with bacon and cheese and coffee, I was walking on the path to the patio to finish my coffee and smoke a Newport before homeroom. The patio was a large brick square outside of the cafeteria of the school where kids would hang out, smoke, and posture. Several hundred yards before I reached it, suddenly a semicircle of about a dozen white girls closed in around me, and they were all hyped up to fight. They were screaming at the same time, and the hardest girl of them all broke out from the pack and advanced towards me. I was freaked out but tried not to show how scared I was. The bagel in my stomach had turned into rocket fuel and was going off in my belly, and my head was spinning, trying to devise something to say to defuse or derail the situation, because surely I was not going to fight. I may have had a tough exterior and a wise-ass mouth, but I never wanted to actually fight anyone. I used my wits to survive. Plus, I was the fastest runner in the school, except for one boy. The crowd had gotten close enough that the heat of their mob mentality was singeing the hairs on my arms. I had to say something, so I opened my mouth and just started yelling. I have no idea what. What I will never forget is seeing their bravado instantly wither into meekness while they slowly edged backward and quickly dispersed. For a quick instant, I thought I had really told them off, but then I felt a powerful energy behind me. I turned around, and looking like a fly girl teen version of a Black Panther protest, there was a big, beautiful wall of every style, size, and shade of every black girl I knew in school. "Oh, we got your back," one of them said. And that was it. There was no debate over how black I was or whether I looked white. Those badass girls just let me know that when it got down to it, they were going to hold me down. Years later, after the release of Vision of Love, I was all over the radio and on TV. My mother was still living on Long Island, and I asked her if we could drive by the house where the prettiest girl and her sisters lived. I stopped the car, got out, and just looked at the modest structure, a symbol of what I had survived. My mother, wrapped in a fur coat, got out too. The father of the family, the one who beat the mother, came to the door and in his dense, twangy Long Island accent shouted, "Oh, look, Pat's gone Hollywood." The rest of the family filed out of the house. The prettiest one was stunned. She couldn't believe it had happened. The mutt mulatto bitch who lived in the shabby shack down the street had become a star. The brother called out, "You're a loser." That family, that house, that town, that time, that day, suddenly, it all looked like nothing to me. It was nothing in nowhere, and I had made it out. As I turned to get back in the car, I heard the blonde girl crying after me. Mariah, I'm so happy for you. I'm so happy for you. And she became the prettiest sister of them all.
Yes, I've been bruised, grew up confused, been destitute. I've seen life from many sides, been stigmatized, been black and white. Felt inferior inside until my saving grace shined on me. Until my saving grace set me free, giving me peace.
My saving grace. Part 2. Sing Sing. A prelude to Sing Sing.
Near in the end, oblivious, I almost fell right over. A part of me will never be quite able to stay.
Close my eyes. Even now, it's hard to explain, to put into words how I existed in my relationship with Tommy Mottola. It's not that there are no words. It's just that they still get stuck moving up from my gut, or they disappear into the thickness of my anxiety. Tommy's energy was intense, more than overbearing. For me, it was an entire atmosphere. Even before he would enter the room, I could sense the air change and my breath grow short. He rolled over me like a fog. His presence felt dense and oppressive. He was like humidity, inescapable. Never when I was with him did I feel I could breathe easy and fully as myself. His power was pervasive, and with it came an unspeakable unease. In the beginning of our time together, I was walking on eggshells. Then it became a bed of nails, and then a minefield. I never knew when or what would make him blow, and the anxiety was relentless. In the 8 years we were together, I can't recall 10 minutes with him when I felt I could be comfortable, when I could simply be at all. I felt his grip was steadily choking me off from my essence. I was disappearing in installments. It felt like he was cutting off my circulation, keeping me from friends and what little family I had. I couldn't talk to anyone that wasn't under Tommy's control. I couldn't go out or do anything with anybody. I couldn't move freely in my own house. Many nights, I would lie on my side of our massive bed, under which I would keep my purse filled with essentials just in case I had to make a quick escape, my to-go bag. I had to wait for him to fall asleep. Keeping my eyes locked on him, I would gradually inch my way to the edge of the bed and surgically roll my hips and swing my legs to the floor. Never breaking my gaze, I tiptoe backward toward the door, which seemed a full city block away. Ever so carefully, I'd back out of the door. It was such a victory when I made it out of the room. I'd softly creep down the grand dark wood staircase like a burglar stealing a little peace of mind, then make my way to somewhere in the manor. Often I just wanted to go to the kitchen for a snack or to sit at the table and write down some lyrics. But every time, right as I would start to settle into the calm of the quiet dark and begin to find my breath, beep beep, the intercom would go off. I'd jump up and the words, "What you doing?" would crackle through the speaker and I'd gasp and once again lose my own air. Every move I made, everywhere I went, I was monitored minute by minute, day after day, year after year. It was as if I was being crushed right out of myself. Everything he felt he didn't create or control was being strangled away. I created the fun and free girl in my videos so that I could watch a version of myself be alive, live vicariously through her, the girl I pretended to be, the girl I wished was me. I would view my videos as evidence that I existed. I was living my dream, but couldn't leave my house. Lonely and trapped, I was held captive in that relationship. Captivity and control come in many forms, but the goal is always the same: to break down the captive's will, to kill any notion of self-worth and erase the person's memory of their own soul. I'm still not sure of the toll it has taken on me. how much of me was permanently destroyed or arrested. Perhaps, among other things, my ability to completely trust people or to fully rest. But thankfully, I smuggled myself out bit by bit through the lyrics of my songs.
I left the worst unsaid, let it all disappear, and I tried to forget as I closed my eyes.
I sang some of what I couldn't say. Though I do try, I cannot forget. Sometimes, without warning, I am haunted by a nightmare or flashes of suffocating. Sometimes I still feel the heaviness. Sometimes I have no air. Alone in Love. When I was in seventh grade, I had my first professional recording session. I did background vocals on a few original songs, including a cover of the classic R&B ballad, Feel the Fire, originally written and recorded by Peebo Bryson. The session took place in a dinky little home studio, but it was a real job and I got paid real money. It was also when I began to discover how to create nuances and textures in vocal arrangements and how to use my voice to build layers like a painter. This was when my romance with the studio began. This was a major moment that began my journey, my drive to succeed. One session gig led to the next. I was a little big fish in a puddle. The Long Island music scene was pretty small, and word of mouth was the method of marketing yourself. By the time I was 14 or 15, I was writing songs and recording background vocals and jingles for local businesses. I was doing background vocals regularly for these young Wayne's World type of guys. They were into wild, loud guitar riffs and stuff while I was listening to, rather, I was obsessed with contemporary urban radio, which was mostly R&B, hip-hop, and dance music. I lived for the radio. Though our tastes were clearly different, I liked the work nonetheless. I was making demos for songs and commercials and learning how to adapt my voice to the task, whatever it was. The studio was my natural habitat. Like being in the ocean, when I was there, I felt weightless and all my outside concerns fell away. I focused only on the music, and even if I didn't like their songs, I respected the work it took to make them. One day, while we were working on one of their mishmashes of a song, I told them I was a songwriter too. I figured if we could work on their corny stuff, why couldn't we work on my stuff? Technically, I had been writing since before I was a teenager. I wrote poems and sketches of songs in my diary. Every once in a while, I would be alone in the house, or my mother would be asleep, and I would have a moment of lightness in the small, dim living room, sitting on the wooden piano stool at my mother's surprisingly well-kept brown upright Yamaha piano. I would prop my diary on the music shelf, feet dangling. I'd hum a bit of a melody, search for the keys that were the closest to my voice. Then, very quietly, nearly whispering, I'd sing a few words with the melody. I trusted the music I was hearing in my head. I believed it was akin to the popular songs I heard on the radio. My songs didn't mimic the style or sound of what I heard. Rather, I would always search for the right sound, the one that felt like me. And I believed my sound would fit in with or even break through what was on the radio. I really believed that. I knew what I was hearing was advanced for my age, but luckily, I was working with two guys who were very collaborative and open to working with such a young and female artist. So it was there in their mother's house, in a sad little slap-together studio, that I wrote and produced one of my favorite demos, To Begin. I still love it, but sadly, it's among one of the many lost tapes of Little Mariah. I was confident I had a solid song. They were like, "Why are we listening to this little kid?" Honestly, I just don't think they understood the culture, genres, and tones I was working with. They really were a weird little garage band, hippie-ish type guys. Indeed, I was a little kid, but I also knew where the pulse of the culture was and that they were not anywhere near it. The discipline of working with them was good for me, but by the time I was 15, I had outgrown them. One of my first regular gigs was with these two sketchy guys who made demos. They liked my sound because I had that young girl quality that was popular at the time, largely because of Madonna's success. But I was actually a young girl, and my vocals could get into that high pitch range naturally. I could emulate the popular Madonna studio technique, but with my voice alone. I auditioned by singing one of the songs they wrote, and they hired me on the spot. So the sketchy guys began paying me to sing demos. This was the official start of my professional career, and of a never-ending succession of sketchy characters that came with it. I I had entered the treacherous territory of the music industry. Though my journey was just beginning, I would soon be initiated into the complicated dynamics that female artists have to endure. As I now know, most don't make it through. There were weird vibes from the start because I couldn't really tell if these guys were pervy or not, but I believe nothing crazy would happen because they both had wives who were around all the time. Naively, I thought these women might take on big sister type roles with me. They were all full-blown adults and I was still just a child, but unfortunately, my age and talent caused friction. Even though I was a scrawny little teenager, I mean, my body was pretty much a straight line at that age, one of the wives was threatened by me. She was always close by, prancing around in short shorts, giving me evil energy. I didn't understand what was going on. I was too young to get it, and also, I was there to work. Maybe my own short shorts were inappropriate around these older men. I didn't know. I was just a kid getting her first whiff of independence, and besides, a few pairs of cheap shorts and tops were all I owned. I was in a battle of the short shorts, and I didn't even know it. I continued recording demos of songs for the guys, making a little money, but again, just as with the garage band dudes, we were putting down their songs, though I believe my songs were stronger. And again, I asked if they were open to me writing some songs. Initially, they refused. It was totally frustrating. Here I was singing weird, corny songs again. Didn't these people even listen to the radio, I wondered? Didn't they know what was popular? I studied the music on the radio closely, constantly analyzing what was in heavy rotation. I knew the songs they were writing weren't good. Despite not liking the material, I sang it because it was my job, and I really needed the money. But now that I'd had a taste of making demos, I knew I needed to get my own songs down, and quickly. Later, I was able to make a deal with one of the guys who owned a studio. I would sing demos for him if he would let me work on my own. I brought in one of the songs I had begun at my mother's piano at the shack, called Alone in Love. I sat in a room alone and began to make my very first demos, my own.
Swept me away, but now I'm lost in the dark. Set me on fire, but now I'm left with a spark. Alone you got me, I'm hazy. I'm lost inside the maze. I guess I'm all alone in love.
Alone in Love. I figured out the setup. I experimented with the songs. I did dance tracks straight down the line, all different sounds. I learned how to produce under pressure. I was in the studio doing it. Alone in Love was one of the first tracks on my demo. A version of the song eventually made it onto my first album and remains one of my favorites.
You haunt me in my dreams. I'm calling out your name. I watch you fade away. Your love is not the same.
I figured out your style to quickly drift apart. You held me for a while, planned it from the start.
All alone in love.
I was in 11th grade. I distinctly remember one night bleeding into morning. The pink of dawn was seeping through the edges of the deep purple night sky, and I didn't know where the hell I was again. Somewhere on the Taconic Parkway or maybe the Cross Bronx Expressway, clutching the hard plastic steering wheel of my mother's rickety old Cutlass Supreme, I tried to stay focused on the road and not stress over the needle of the gas gauge that stayed twitching on E. Every day was a struggle, with me trying to find my way home after work just to grab a few hours of sleep before I had to get to school. I'd recently graduated out of the Long Island music scene. My brother, who was also trying to make a name for himself in the music industry as a manager or a producer, I'm not sure what, had introduced me to a new crop of session musicians and studio engineers in the city, New York City. I began commuting to the city to do sessions at night and then would turn right back around and head to the island to get to school the next morning. So began my first double life, kind of. Very few of my peers at school knew what I was doing. They didn't know I was driving alone on highways, getting lost at midnight, collapsing on my bed, then dragging myself to school. They didn't know why I was late every day. I didn't talk about it because I knew it would sound crazy and most people didn't have the ability to really believe as hard as I did. Besides, the kids I knew didn't need to believe. They were getting new cars, Camaros, and Mustangs for their 16th birthdays. They had their paths mapped out and were financed for generations to come. Most were certain they were going to college. They had a guaranteed life already planned out for them. I remember that once, one of the most popular jocks in the school asked me what I was doing after graduation. I usually didn't tell any of the kids around about my dreams, but in this case, I did. I told him I was going to be a singer and songwriter. His response was, "Yeah, right. You'll be working at Hojo's in 5 years. Hojo's was short for Howard Johnson's, the chain of hotels and restaurants that was still widely popular then. The degradation was totally intended. As it turns out, in less than 3 years, in a simple black dress with a head full of curls and a stomach full of, yes, butterflies, I walked through a packed stadium among the deafening buzz of tens of thousands of voices. A loud, clear voice cut through the cacophony. "Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Columbia recording artist Mariah Carey for the singing of America the Beautiful." The piano track was recorded by Richard T. I held a little mic and sang the big song with everything I had. I hit a really high note on the "Sea Too Shining," and the stadium erupted. When I finished, the announcer said, "The palace now has a queen, and the goosebumps will continue." It was game one of the NBA Finals between Detroit and Portland. I knew that the jock who condemned me to Hojo's, no shade on anyone in service work because I've been there, and everyone who had looked down on me and millions of Americans were watching. None of the players, none of the fans knew who I was when I walked in, but they would remember me when I walked out. A victory. Another very early, high-visibility, big breakthrough moment, Vision of Love was number one on the R&B charts before it was in the top spot on the pop charts. And so, my national television debut was on the Arsenio Hall show. Arsenio was more than a host. He had more than a late-night show. It was a cultural event, a true black experience, or rather, it was a mainstream entertainment show seen through a black lens. Everyone watched it and talked about it everywhere. I will always be grateful and proud that it was on Arsenio's stage that most of America got to see my face, know my name, and hear my song for the first time. In my teens, living in a constant state of exhaustion and exhilaration became my new normal. But with every mile driven and each dawn met, I was more and more determined. My ambition grew to the level of devotion, and the hard-earned blessings were beginning to come down. My brother did manage to connect me with a reputable producer and writer named Gavin Christopher. Gavin had written big hits for Rufus, the band for which Chaka Khan sang lead, and produced songs for Grandmaster Flash and Afrika Bambaataa. We instantly clicked and began working together to produce one of my first professional demos. I also met his girlfriend, Clarissa, another singer, and we got along well. I liked them both, and I could feel the stirrings of a new life in the city appearing before me. Making valuable connections in New York City was certainly crucial to my career, but getting out of my mother's house was no longer just a desire. It was a necessity. When I was younger, I had no control over our constant moves and my mother's consistently poor choices in men. In my last year of high school, she began dating a guy I despised. He was petty and manipulative. On Thanksgiving, we all went out to dinner, and he actually insisted that I and my nephew Sean, who was in middle school, Allison's first son, pay for our portions of dinner. He divided up the receipt evenly among the people present and demanded we pay our share. So after I gave him the few pitiful, crumpled up dollars I had in my pockets, which was just about all the money I had, Sean and I left and went to the movies to see Back to the Future 2. No thanks to him. When my mother decided to marry him, I knew it was my cue to move out. I guess she thought she had struck it rich marrying this guy because he had a boat in the West 79th Street boat basin. But that was where he lived before he crashed into the shack. And trust me, his boat was more tugboat than yacht. Eventually, she ended that abominable marriage. The divorce took multiple years and many lawyer fees, which of course I paid for after the success of my first record. Then the jerk even ended up suing me for the rights to some fictitious Mariah Carey doll. If I had a dollar for every deadbeat who sued me, I'd be, well, it's been a lot. But I was the polar opposite of rich when I moved out of my mother's house. I was broke and 17 years old. It was the late 1980s, and I was living completely on my own in New York City. Fate is a bizarre thing. When I was about 7, we were living in that cramped apartment on top of the deli, and I used to love to hear the sounds of the radio coming up into our windows. I remember swaying, posing, and singing with Odyssey.
Oh, you're a native New Yorker. You should know the score by now.
I didn't know what knowing the score was, but I wanted that fabulous New York feeling even back then. It took 10 more years, but I had finally arrived. To me, the city had a raw grit and an impossible chicness. It was in perpetual motion, masses of people walking fast, no one looking the same, but all moving in sync. The city was crazy messenger bikes whizzing around and countless long yellow cabs zigzagging through the streets like a swarm of rough bumblebees. Something was happening everywhere you looked. Huge billboards, flashing neon signs, wild graffiti emblazoned across all kinds of surfaces, covering subway cars, water towers, and vans. It was like one big, funky, moving art gallery. The main avenues were grand, crowded catwalks filled with eclectic fashion models, business moguls, street hustlers, and workers of every ilk, all strutting and with no one studying each other. Everyone had somewhere to go and something to do. It was a mad and fabulous planet of concrete and crystals populated with misfits, magicians, dreamers, and dealers. I landed right in the middle of it. Hello, babe. I was made for this. Make it happen. After moving out of my mother's house, I crashed at Morgan's empty apartment on top of Charlie Mom Chinese Cuisine in Greenwich Village while he was in Italy pursuing a modeling career and Lord knows what else. I fed his two cats, Ninja and Tompkins, and tried my best to feed myself. The first decision of every day was whether I was going to get a bagel from H&H or buy a Subway token. I was surviving on a dollar a day and something had to give. It was either breakfast or transportation. H&H bagels were sublime. Soft, warm, and plump to perfection. A classic NYC morning staple that would keep my stomach occupied until 3 o'clock. H&H stood for Helmer and Hector, the two Puerto Rican owners who arguably made the best kosher bagels in the world. But then again, getting around is pretty important, and the New York City subway was the rowdiest but most direct route to anywhere in town. The token was slightly bigger than a dime, a dirty gold disc with NYC stamped in the middle and a distinctive slim Y cutout. This was the people's coin, and it could get you anywhere at any time. But if I could walk to where I needed to go, breakfast would win. I found a job right away. I didn't have a choice. So I did what every other broke dreamer does when they get to New York City. I grabbed the free newspaper of Real New Yorkers, The Village Voice, and checked out the job ads. I took what I could get, and what I got was work at a sports bar on 77th and Broadway, cleverly named Sports on Broadway. I began as a waitress, but as management soon discovered, I was still a teen and couldn't legally serve drinks, so I was moved to the cash register. Boy, was that a disaster. I was a hard worker, but I had spent most of my working time in a recording studio, and working a register isn't like recording background vocals. I wasn't picking it up fast. And this was a neighborhood joint with regulars and no-nonsense waitresses, like Kiss My Grits, Flo, and Alice, but New York tough. Those broads hated me for messing up their money. Eventually, I got moved to the Kochek. Simple. But while I was hustling, I was also getting hustled. I wasn't allowed to keep my tips, which is pretty much the entire allure of being a Kochek girl. I got a dollar for every coat. I knew it wasn't fair, but I also knew it was temporary. When summertime came around, the Kochek was converted into a merchandise booth, and I became the Sports on Broadway t-shirt girl. The booth was right at the front door, so the first thing the men would see was me with a welcoming smile in a white t-shirt with the word sports printed across my boobs. I was grateful for the simplicity of it all. The uniform was the barest t-shirt and jeans, and since I only had one pair of jeans, it was one less thing for me to struggle to buy.
None more than 3 short years ago, I was abandoned and alone, without a penny to my name. So very young and so afraid, no proper shoes upon my feet. Sometimes I couldn't even eat, I often cried myself to sleep, but said I had to keep on going.
Make it happen. I also only had one pair of shoes, and they were a size and a half too small. They had been my mother's pitiful, flat, black leather lace-up ankle boots. They were basic and utilitarian, and I made them work. At some point, the top of the shoe separated from the rubber sole, creating a flap that would slap the unforgiving city pavement as I pounded toward my destiny. The swelling of my feet from standing all day in two small shoes surely contributed to their demise. Snowy days were the worst. Ice would slide into the flap, melt, and seep through my thin socks, and the clammy sensation of wet, cheap leather traveled up my spine. And that year, New York had a big, newsworthy snowstorm. But I'd pull myself together, as cute as I could manage, and flash a smile, pleasantly doing my job and just hoping no one would look down at my feet. I had years of training for living through humiliation, but now I wasn't in school. I was living in the city. I believed in my heart that one day I would make it and have some of the most fancy and well-fitting shoes imaginable. I had my mighty faith, but I was also blessed with so many signs and acts of kindness from folks along the way. Like Charles, the cook at Sports, who would fry me up a greasy cheeseburger and sneak it to me with a glass of Sambuca. It wasn't glamorous, but I had a meal, an outfit, and a few dollars. Every day that I made it through, I knew I was closer to my dream. I would drop down on my knees each night and thank God for another day when I didn't give up or get taken down. I know life can be so tough and you feel like giving up, but you must be strong. Baby, just hold on. You'll never find the answers if you throw your life away. I used to feel the way you do. Still, I had to keep on going.
Make it happen.
The job at the sports bar was a means, but the studio was the end. Everything went into my demo. One day, while I was eating downstairs in the Chinese restaurant, gratefully savoring the cheap morsels of the day's only meal, I noticed a familiar face. It was Clarissa, the now ex-girlfriend of my brother's producer friend, Gavin Christopher. We hugged like old friends. I told her that I had officially relocated to the city. When I gave her the rundown on my chaotic living arrangements, like an angel, she invited me to come live with her. Though she identified as a struggling artist, fortunately for me, Clarissa wasn't really struggling that hard. She lived with a gay couple in a huge classic Upper West Side brownstone on 85th Street between Central Park West and Columbus Avenue. I suspected that she was one of those kids who had a trust fund waiting for her once she got over her starving artist phase. My music was my life. Music was the only plan, ever. While it was certainly an upgrade from my previous crowded crash pad, living with Clarissa still had its challenges. She had a room, with a whole door which closed, where there was a loft-style bed set up with recording equipment underneath it. Her room was off to the side of the larger parlor room. My situation was a ragtag, loft-like structure built above the kitchen in the communal area that we shared with the couple. To get to my sleeping cranny, I had to climb up onto the kitchen counter and hoist myself up into the teeny nook. It was barely more than a crawl space and had just enough room for a twin mattress, outfitted with a single pillow and a blanket, a housewarming gift from my mother. The space was so shallow and the ceiling was so close that I couldn't fully kneel on the bed without bumping my head, so there I prayed on my back. It was decorated with the only remnants from my life in Long Island, my journals and diaries, my Marilyn Monroe poster, and a handful of books on Marilyn. I still looked up to her. Connecting with Clarissa proved to be quite the blessing. She helped me find work and covered for me when I couldn't make my share of the $500 a month rent, a fortune to me then. Occasionally, she'd take me out to eat. We even did some songwriting in her mini studio. She had a few connections in the music scene from her time with Gavin and would sometimes introduce me to other musicians who also lived on the Upper West Side. On these special occasions, she'd even loan me a little black dress to wear, not dissimilar to what I'm wearing on my first album cover. I certainly didn't have anything of my own that was appropriate for mingling. Like everything during that time, nothing lasted long. Eventually, the addition of some crazy roommates meant that Clarissa and I fled for our lives. I really can't get into the details of that, and had to move on and out. We joined my friend Josephine, whom I had met when she was in an open relationship with my brother. She was living with a few other girls from Sweden, so it was five random girls living in a random apartment on top of a club called Rascals on East 14th Street. I was downgraded to a mattress on the floor, but I was now living downtown in the heart of the New York art scene of the late 1980s. It was thrilling, if precarious, and my eyes were always focused upward. I was able to gain a bit of stability and a lot more faith. I knew more than ever that it was going to happen for me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. I got my feet on solid ground. Thank you, Lord. If you believe within your soul, just hold on tight and don't let go. You can make it.
Make it happen.
After a few months, the other girls from Sweden moved out, and it was Josephine and I. She helped me get odd jobs, but I was also beginning to pick up more background vocal work. For this work, I'd settled on my young singer ensemble, a little black knit tank dress, black tights, and fat, slouchy socks over a pair of white Reebok freestyle sneakers, my mother's hand-me-down black shoes having finally been reduced to shreds. Previously, Clarissa had encouraged me to ask my mother to buy me new shoes. My mother then asked Morgan, who, she reported to me, said, she has to learn to do things by herself. I was a teen living on my own in the city, but whatever. Eventually, reluctantly, Morgan did buy me a pair of white Reeboks. Why not black, I wondered, which goes with everything. But I was grateful to have shoes that fit and were without involuntary air conditioning. I wore this outfit to nearly every session. It was like my uniform. Gavin and I were working on a song together. While we were recording, he introduced me to a producer in the city, Ben Margulies, who was hired as a drummer on the session for our song called Just Can't Hold It Back. Ben had his own studio, and I had begun working with him occasionally during my singer-student Long Island commuter days. His studio was in Chelsea on 19th Street between 6th and 7th Avenues. Located in the back of his father's cabinet-making factory, it was about the size of a pantry. It could have been a chicken coop for all I cared, and it honestly wasn't far from that. What mattered was that it was almost a full recording studio, the place where I belonged. For me, the studio is part sanctuary, part playground, and part laboratory. I loved being there, writing, riffing, singing, dreaming, and taking risks. I've slept many a night on many a studio floor, beginning with this humble yet magical place. Ben and I worked incessantly over the course of a year or so. Occasionally, his partner Chris would be there, helping with the programming. I was coming up with a lot of ideas and we were recording, but I still felt the guys weren't going fast enough. I was hitting a new stride. I was coming up with all these lyrics and melodies and was frustrated because it seemed to me like it should be going faster. Maybe because I was only 17 and extremely impatient, but I felt I was differently invested, like I was on a different trajectory than they were. Music was my whole life. So much of my belief system, my survival, was entwined in my songs. There was an urgency in my air, in the moment, and in me. This was my time, and I could feel it. I felt like I was running fast towards something or someone soon, and I was not about to let anyone or anything slow me down. Ben and I were both excited by the songs we were working on, but ultimately our sensibilities and ambitions were incompatible. I think he thought we were going to form a duo like the Eurythmics, with him as co-lead, the Dave Stewart to my Annie Lennox. I was like, good luck with that. Can we just focus on putting down my songs, please? We were able to create a full demo that I thought really showcased my songwriting and vocal styles. My most vivid memory of being in that studio is of me sitting by myself on the floor in the corner, writing lyrics and melodies, or staring out the window, dreaming of the day I would break through. Look, Ben was very committed, and I spent a lot of time working with him, and we got a lot done. But I had a vision, even back then, that my career had the capacity to go way beyond what he or most people around me were even capable of imagining. Ben suggested we have some security in place by way of a formal agreement, so he photocopied a contract out of the book All You Need to Know About the Music Business, co-written by Don Passman, who would, ironically enough, several years later become my lawyer. With no parent, legal counsel, manager, or even a good friend, I signed it. I was maybe 18 years old. Obviously, I didn't know much about contracts and deals then, but what I did know was that there was value in my lyrics and the songs. I remembered seeing a documentary on the Beatles when I was growing up and being shocked that they didn't have complete ownership of the songs they'd written. The Beatles. So I knew not to give away all my publishing. Some of the lyrics to songs like Alone in Love, I had begun writing in early high school. We started setting up meetings with record companies and things began to move fast. We got an initial offer from a major publishing company for a song called All in Your Mind. I remember they offered me $5,000 for the publishing.
Come closer, you seem so far away.
There's something I know you need to say. I feel your emotions when I look in your eyes. Your silence whispering misunderstandings. There's so much you need to realize. You'll feel my emotions if you look in my eyes.
Hey, darling, I know you think my love is slipping away, but baby, it's all in your mind.
All in your mind? I refused, even though back then, $5,000 seemed like a million, which was how much I got from my first real publishing administration deal. Thank God I had a cautionary Beatles tale fresh in my mind. I didn't sell because I believed my songs came from somewhere special inside of me and that selling them would be selling a piece of me. The music business is designed to confuse and control the artist. Later, seasoned music executives told me that Ben's deal was truly a golden ticket. I was trying to be loyal to someone who believed in me at a crucial time, but in my naivete, I didn't realize the enormity of what I had signed away. I was informed, and what I remember, was that he got 50% of the publishing on all songs we worked on together for my first album. Okay, fine. But additionally, he received 50% of my artist royalties for the first album, 40% for the second album, 30% for the third, and so on. It went on that way from 1990 until about 1999, even though Ben didn't write one word or note with me after the first album. Out of loyalty to him and the hard work we put in together in that little studio, I never looked back and never tried to reset or recoup. So yeah, a photocopy. That's the unceremonious origin of my first official deal. What a welcome to the music business, which I was so eager to get into, but soon I came to believe that my first signature was on a pretty shady piece of paper and one that would be hard to get out of. But it certainly wouldn't be the last. A whole forest full of shade was yet to come. One must pick one's battles wisely, and I wasn't about to come for someone who I had already left behind. I was on my way. I'll be eternally grateful, and I wish him well. At least we made the demo. That demo stayed in my Walkman, which stayed on my hip, and the music stayed in my ears. Aside from the radio, the songs we laid down were all I listened to, and the offers from the major publishing houses gave me confidence that things were going to happen. I just had to keep the faith and keep working. I didn't stop. I kept going to more sessions, doing more connecting, and getting more background vocal work. I began doing vocals for the musician and producer T.M. Stevens, who'd written with Narda Michael Walden and played bass with James Brown, Cyndi Lauper, Joe Cocker, and other major artists. It was through him that I had the good fortune to meet the amazing Cindy Mizell at a session. Since that first background gig at 12 years old, I'd gained a respect for the specific skill and talent it takes to be a good background vocalist. I would listen specifically to background vocals on the radio. I'd study the liner notes on albums and CD jackets to learn who was doing the background vocals, especially on dance records, as I believe backgrounds are what makes those songs. I became familiar with all those exceptional singers like Audrey Wheeler and Lisa Fisher and Cindy. To me, she was one of the absolute greatest. Cindy Mizell was the background singer. She sang with the most gifted vocalists of all time, Barbra Streisand, Whitney Houston, Luther Vandross, and the Rolling Stones. She was a real singer-singer. Cindy was that girl to me. I looked up to her so much. I remember in the beginning of the session, we were at the microphone doing a part that I was having a difficult time getting right. Cindy's such a perfectionist, as I am now, but she had patience with me. When you first learn how to do background vocals, different tones and styles, it's not easy. Producers liked my tone, but I had to learn how to really get in the pocket to get it exactly how they wanted it. Precision takes practice. Cindy had a new gig practically every day. She was a master. When I first started singing alongside her, I had to work hard to keep up. Now, background vocals are one of my favorite elements in building a song. I love the textures and layers and how lush they can make a song. Backgrounds get into your bones. Once, while Cindy and I were recording and standing very close to each other at the microphone, she could hear my stomach rumbling. She looked down and saw the sad shoes I was wearing, scanned my crumpled outfit, and then looked up at me with pity and recognition. I was too excited to be self-conscious at that point in life. My ambition was stronger than my shame. Who cared if I arrived a little hungry and a little shabby? I was finally singing for a living, right next to a consummate professional. Cindy gave me her number that night and told me if I ever needed anything, I could call her. I didn't know what to do with that. She'd sung with huge acts all around the world. What business did I have calling her? What would I say? I didn't call, and the next time I saw her, she called me out on it. It wasn't easy for me to ask for help. I didn't want to bother or burden her, I explained. Cindy looked me in the eye and said, "Mariah, you need to call me." Suddenly, it struck me. Oh, I get it. I was supposed to call her. I hadn't understood right away that this was part of the process, the initiation, the mentoring, the nurturing, the entry into a society of sister singers. These rituals were all new to me, and I was unfamiliar with being welcomed into a family of artists, into a family of any kind. Once I had broken into the inner circle of elite background vocalists, recommendations started to come in. Background vocalists are hired by word of mouth. One singer will recommend another, and good singers like to work together. If the squad is strong, the session is strong. And if the sessions are strong, the money is good and steady. I was now in the tight and talented community of working musicians in New York City. Though I was invariably the youngest in the crowd, I also often hung out with some of them outside of work hours, mostly on Manhattan's Upper West Side. I wasn't into drinking or hooking up at all. The hang, to me, was about networking, the emphasis on work. It paid off. I got an offer to do a demo session for a group called Maggie's Dream. When I got to the gig, I was told I would be singing for a male vocalist. In walked this sexy, serene, toasted almond-colored, artsy young man. He just looked like the definition of an artist. His thick, dark hair was just in the beginning phases of dreadlocks. He had a perfect 5 o'clock shadow with a thick stripe of goatee down the center of his chin. He was dressed rock star casual, heavy black leather vintage motorcycle jacket, black jeans, black t-shirt. He had a thin ring in his nose and smelled how I imagined ancient Egyptian oils would smell. His face was kind and fine with a boyish smile. He went by the name of Romeo Blue. His friends called him Lenny. And about a year later, the world would know him as Lenny Kravitz. Maggie's Dream had a drummer named Tony, who was also the drummer for the band of a singer named Brenda K. Starr. Brenda had a big R&B pop hit out called I Still Believe, which the record company was looking to rework. There was an opening for background singers, and Tony got me a slot at the audition. I was excited because Brenda had a big song on the radio, and you know how much I love the radio. At the audition, we were asked to sing Brenda's song right in front of the table where she sat. I gave it my all. I sang for my life. I did all kinds of runs and belted out the last note. When I was finished, I stood perfectly still, returning back to earth, heart on fire. Brenda gave me a long, flat stare, then suddenly broke into a mischievous little giggle. In her clipped, nasally accent, she said, "You trying to steal my job?" I didn't move, but her giggle turned into hearty laughter. "I didn't realize you weren't supposed to outsing the singer who could hire you." "Mariah is my new best friend," she said, breaking my trance. "Wait, she knew my name? I couldn't believe someone who had a major song on the radio knew my name." Immediately after the audition, Brenda had to fly somewhere to perform, but as soon as she returned, I was hired. She kept saying, "I told everybody about this girl, Mariah." Brenda was a spicy mix in the true meaning of the word. She grew up in the projects on 90th and Amsterdam Avenue, and the culture of the projects grew in her. She told me her mother was Puerto Rican and Hawaiian, and her father, Harvey Kaplan, was Jewish and in a band called The Spiral Staircase. They had a hit song, "More Today Than Yesterday." Brenda was a bit older and more street savvy than I was and had an effortless and silly sense of humor. It was easy to become friends. My life as a professional singer was moving swiftly, but at the same time, I was still a teenager. One time, I was hanging out with the guys from Maggie's Dream, and one of them started teasing me because I was a virgin. Apparently, Clarissa had told them I was. Everybody was laughing, but I didn't get why it was funny. I was a kid. I was always the youngest and clearly the most idealistic, so I had to suffer through some of the more crass amusements of adult musicians. I may have been young and naive, but Brenda knew my songs were good and wise beyond their years. When I let her listen to my demo, she said, "Ooh, Mariah, I want to do this on my next album." She currently had a song that was still in active rotation on the radio, and every time we were together and I heard it play, it was mind-blowing. I couldn't believe I was working with her and she was my friend, not to mention that she had given me my biggest gig to date. Yet I said, "I know I don't have anything big going on yet, but I'm sorry, I have to keep these songs. These songs are the ones I wrote for me." I may have been insecure about my money, my clothes, my family, and a whole host of other things, but I knew my songs were valuable. I was really excited to finally be in the company of young and some struggling current musicians and artists, but the truth was that I had always believed that this would happen to me. Brenda never pushed me to use my songs after that. Singing background with Brenda while she toured with her big song was big fun. Once, we went to Los Angeles to appear at a popular radio station's concert. It was the first time I'd ever been to LA and one of the few times I'd ever set foot on a plane. Now, I was boarding a plane as a professional singer going to do a big outdoor radio-sponsored concert in LA. To me, being on the radio was being famous. For the show, Brenda was set to sing I Still Believe with me as one of the background vocalists. Will Smith was there, too, to perform Parents Just Don't Understand. Jeffrey Osborne from the group LTD was also there. He did You Should Be Mine, the Woo Woo song, as part of his set. I was in the audience watching. Jeffrey, the veteran among us, began singing the chorus to his song with his seasoned, smooth voice. "And you woo woo woo." He